everyone. This is Holly Herndon.
And Matt Dryhurst.
And you're listening to
Interdependence.
Good. This is John.
Great to meet you, John. Where are you joining us from?
Right now, we're west of Toronto in Canada.
How's the COVID situation there? Are you somewhat living in the future? We're still in lockdown here in Germany.
You know, Ontario actually has had, they relaxed the restrictions in February and they had a big resurgence. So now they're cracking down again. But so it was a mistake of the provincial government, unfortunately. But in any case, hopefully we'll get back to getting it under control soon enough.
We all see some light at the end of the tunnel, I think.
Yeah, I think so too.
Well, I'm continually seeing light at the end of the tunnel and it's continually being extinguished, sadly.
Alas, I think we're all kind of bored with this.
Yeah.
But could you do us a favor and could you introduce yourself to our listeners?
I'm John Kumi. I've been studying information technology, energy use, and environmental impacts for about 3 decades. And I've published on understanding kind of long-term trends in efficiency. I've done work understanding data centers and how electricity use is growing or not there. And I've done work on critical thinking skills to help people understand the pitfalls that you face when you're trying to understand claims that people make. And there are a lot of claims about information technology, energy use that are out there, and a lot of them are nonsense. And so I try to use examples from that field to illustrate the pitfalls that people can fall into when they try to grab a number that they hear on the news and use it for making a decision.
Yeah, that's really great. We were looking at your book, Turning Numbers into Knowledge, which I believe was first released in 2003 and has had 3 subsequent editions. Is it
2001,
3 or 4?
Actually. And yeah, it's in the third edition. It was published in 2017. And so it has a small but enthusiastic audience. And I use it to train students and people I hire on critical thinking skills. And I've used it to give training workshops for companies. But right now, it's just a labor of love. It's something that I think is pretty polished. And with the next edition, I'll add some more up-to-date anecdotes. But it's something that stood the test of time. And it's something that my mother read, and she liked it. And she's not very technical. So it's not just because she's my mother. She actually thought, well, this is actually pretty good.
Well, great. We're going to add a link to our show notes and you'll probably get some more fans.
Yeah, there'll be some more subs
through that. But what we really liked about this book is that you really explain how to combine numbers with logic in order to come to accurate conclusions. And we're particularly interested in how you outline the false analysis of the use of electricity by office equipment and the internet around the turn of the century, which spread and became a kind of common knowledge, or even if we want to call it a moral panic. So can you tell us a little bit about some of the analysis and predictions at the turn of the century and how you went about debunking them?
Let's set the stage. The late 1990s, the late 1990s was the first tech boom. And everything, you know, every company was moving to the web. And there it was, the, you know, these massive IPOs and lots of hype around different kinds of companies that had no business model. You know, pets.com is the archetypal one, you know, and then a lot of these things started and then crashed and burned when this bubble popped. Now, at the same time as the tech boom was happening, there was also the California electricity crisis, which happened in the kind of 2000-ish timeframe. And there were people in whose interest it was to fan the flames of concern about growth in electricity use. And there were at least a couple of people who were quite vociferous in their belief that the internet begins with coal, and if we did anything about climate change, it would kill the internet economy and so on. And that was kind of the beginning of their thinking, if you want to call it that, about this topic. And they produced a number of very high profile articles, books, published in the Wall Street Journal. And the claims were simple, that the internet used 8% of all electricity use in the United States, that all computers, including the internet, use 13%. And then that total was going to grow to 50% in 10 or 20 years. And so they were trying to make an argument that there would be massive growth in electricity use driven by increasing adoption of this important technology, information technology. So that was the premise of their arguments. And this happened at the same time as the California electricity crisis was happening. And so they and others jumped to the conclusion, the incorrect conclusion, it turned out, that somehow that crisis was about massive increases in electricity demand driven by computing. And that turned out to be false. We can talk about the reasons why I think that is the case. But it all kind of fed together into this hysteria, if you will. And there were at least six investment banking reports. And if you've done any investing at all, you know that these companies, these banks, produce these reports to kind of give their analysis of what's happening. And these six reports took as gospel the assumptions of the two people who were most aggressive in promoting the idea of massive growth in electricity use from information technology. They took that as gospel and then used it to give stock recommendations. So if you think that electricity use is going to grow really fast, there are certain kinds of companies that would benefit. One of them, one type would be companies that make generation technology. And during this period, I actually got a call from the leader of the generation technology group at General Electric. And they wanted to know whether this was true, because obviously that would be a great thing for them, right? Because they build power plants. Yeah. And so I had to disappoint them.
Wrong number.
But the point is that this had penetrated pretty far. I mean, you had secretaries of energy, both Democrats and Republicans, citing these numbers. You had, you know, CEOs from all different companies citing these numbers. One of the statistics got into Doonesbury, which is the first and probably last time that anything I work on or was close to would end up in a in a popular comic strip. It gives you an idea of just how far this idea penetrated.
Yeah, it's wild. I was looking through when we were initially in touch. You gracefully shared with us a paper called "Sorry, Wrong Number." It was a great title. And yeah, it was quite wild to see like quite how many
reputable
media sources were spreading these rumors, right? Like it was like the New York Times. It was basically the who's who of kind of reputable people who I can only assume at that time, with there being not very much fluency about what this emerging new tech was, right? And this is pre-social media. So maybe not a great ability to discover your own information about it, that would have traveled really far. Cause how else would you have come to those conclusions or come to your own conclusions at least?
It really did. It became kind of conventional wisdom. It really did travel very far and very quickly. And there is an analyst, a software programmer who came up with a maxim that kind of characterizes one of the reasons why such misinformation goes so far and so fast. And it's called Brandolini's Law. And what it says, paraphrased for a family audience, is that making up numbers about a topic can be done.
You can curse on this podcast.
No, that's okay. I prefer that. So it takes 10 times more effort to debunk incorrect numbers than it does to create incorrect numbers.
Yep.
And it's an asymmetry because I can, making up a number is very simple. And I can do it quickly. I can do it right now while we're talking. But to actually go back and understand the claim that's being made and then put it in the context of research and actual data, things that we've measured, that takes time and it takes many paragraphs. And so we're always going to be behind in terms of debunking this kind of misinformation. And so that's the state that we live in now. And of course, with social media, I think it's even worse. I think things are moving even more quickly than they used to. And so you end up with people making claims like these. And then those claims get cited quickly by lots of people, some of whom with an axe to grind, some of whom not. And then they get disembodied. So the original claim came from many layers of people beyond who's making the claim now, and they have no idea where it came from originally. And it leads to all sorts of problems, particularly with information technology, because things change so fast. We've done empirical work on different trends in information technology. And one of them was an analysis of the electricity intensity of transferring data over broadband. So it characterized the whole system, including all the central offices and the big switches and routers and everything else. And we determined starting around 2000 or so that the efficiency of delivering data over the internet to a broadband connection, like your cable box or your DSL or some other rapid connection in your house, basically doubled every 2 years. And for computing equipment, we've done analysis of the long-term trends. And before 2000, the efficiency of computers running full out doubled every 1.6 years, starting in the mid-1940s. So even before transistors, we still had very rapid improvements in efficiency. And then after 2000, things, for technical reasons, slowed down a bit. We started to run bump into some of these limitations of semiconductor physics. And now the peak output efficiency is doubling every 2.6 years or so. But the point is, if you take data even from a couple of years ago and assume that it's still applicable, you're going to make huge errors. Factors of two at least. And there's a great example recently. I can keep going on like this for a while, so stop me when you...
No, this is great. This is great. Good. We're checking off some of our questions as you're answering.
Yeah, it's okay. He covered Brandolini's law. Check.
So here's a great example. About a year and a half ago, the BBC did an analysis and they tried to analyze the emissions intensity and energy intensity of sending an email. And fair, that's something that is interesting to people. So they did that. Unfortunately, they used data from 2010. So there's this great book by Mike Berners-Lee, who's the brother of Tim Berners-Lee, one of the creators of the World Wide Web. So a credible source, right? Someone who's technically good. Yeah. He wrote this book in 2010 called How Bad Are Bananas? And he wanted to answer the question for a lot of different activities and products, what emissions were associated with those products. And so one of the things he did was he did an assessment of email emissions intensity. And so that's great. Let's assume, without going into any detail, that that's, for 2010 in the UK, that was a good calculation. But to take those numbers in 2020 and say something about the effect of an email on emissions is really a mistake. And there's at least a couple of reasons for that. One is as we talked about, the efficiency of downloading data has improved. It's doubled every 2 years. So in 10 years, that's five doublings. So 2 times 2 times 2 times 2 times 2, that's 32 times more efficient. So you really can't use data from 2010. Even if it was accurate data, which it probably is, you can't use data from 2010 to analyze 2020. So that's a mistake. Mm-hmm. And then the second big thing that's changed is that the emissions intensity of electricity in the UK has dropped a lot. They've almost entirely phased out coal. So over that same period, emissions intensity has dropped by 2/3. So again, if you're worried about emissions for an activity, you need to understand the electricity used for the activity, and then you need to understand the emissions per kilowatt hour of electricity used. And in this example, both of those things dropped massively. So the energy use per sending a gigabyte of data dropped by a factor of 32. The emissions per kilowatt hour of electricity used dropped by 2/3. And so you really can't say anything about current emissions from emails without correcting for those factors. And this is kind of a general problem with information technologies, that things move so fast and people's intuition about what, how fast things change doesn't really work very well in this field, because things change much faster than everyone thinks, and it's exponential. So things accelerate.
Wow. Yeah, I really love this quote from the epilogue in your book from Mark Twain, where he writes, "A lie can travel halfway around the world while the truth is putting on its shoes."
Yeah, that's an old one. I'm not 100% sure that, after I've gotten some emails saying, "Well, that's not really Mark Twain." I have to figure that out.
Very important for you to clarify.
Yeah, I gotta check the Twain quote there. You just reminded me.
Make sure that doesn't go out on the internet and become someone else.
Common knowledge, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But one of the imbalances that you mentioned in your book is that, a lot of these kind of common knowledge mistakes are repeated in kind of just kind of normal articles or in the media, whereas you're often publishing in peer-reviewed journals, which have a much higher standard for kind of truth-seeking, and how much slower that process is and how difficult it is to then kind of debunk something once it's already gone out into the world. So, as you mentioned, with social media, these things are kind of increasing with speed. What's the kind of strategy for those who are working in the kind of like journal publishing space to combat some of this fake news, I guess, if you want to call it that?
Yeah, I'm not sure that the people who run journals think it's their job to combat fake right. news. So that's part of the issue. You've pointed out an important asymmetry, which is that the peer review process, as embodied in journal reviews and publication, is slow. And most people don't actually understand how it works. Unless they're a scientist, they don't really know. And it's a pretty laborious process. I mean, you send in a paper for consideration. They send it out to a few reviewers, typically. And that can take weeks to months, sometimes years, to get feedback. And then you have to respond to that feedback. And if the comments are good and sensible, that's usually not a problem, but that takes time to revise, and then you send it back, and then they look again. And this can take a very long time. And some journals are much faster, but there's a real process of checking that happens. And so that's one of the reasons why, over time, we can say that scientific knowledge is reliable, because ultimately, some mistakes will slip through, but peer review tends to catch them over time. And people are able to think about new things that might be pitfalls or, new aspects of how the data work. And it's true even in technical, highly, physical sciences, not just in economics or public policy, these other areas that might be a little bit more difficult to pin down.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, earlier you alluded to, I was actually wanting to clarify this because I've seen you be, I've seen two citations for Kumi's law. The one being something that you referenced earlier, which is along the lines of, you know, increasing efficiencies over time,
yeah,
that might be worth clarifying for everybody. And also I've seen a reference to you rewording Brandolini's law. Would you mind giving us the proper definition, or at least your amended definition?
Okay, so I don't call it Kumi's law, but some people do.
Okay.
And that's okay. So it emerged from a study that I did in 2011 with some co-authors from Lawrence Berkeley Lab and Intel and Microsoft. And we looked at the efficiency of computing for delivering out peak output from the computer. So basically the computer's running flat out. It can produce a certain number of computations per hour, and it uses a certain number of kilowatt hours per hour. And you divide one by the other and you get computations per kilowatt hour. And it turned out that there is some data for lots of these early computers, the vacuum tube computers, starting with ENIAC. And then for the the discrete transistors that came in starting in the late 50s, early 60s, and then when the microprocessor was created in the late 60s, early 70s, you started to see personal computers. What was remarkable was that when you do the regression from 1945 to 2000-ish, you see this straight line. It's remarkable. It's like it's, you know, doubling time of 1.6 years, more or less, for the efficiency of computing at peak output. So it really was moving quickly, and it was increasing at a pretty steady rate. There was actually kind of a jump during the period when we switched from vacuum tubes to transistors, and you can see that in the data. But the regression to 2000 was pretty straight line. Now, what happened in 2000 or so was that we started to run into some of these limitations in semiconductor physics. And what had been done for 30 plus years with microprocessors is as you ramped up the clock speed, so the computer has a clock, it runs, it's usually megahertz, gigahertz nowadays, and it runs at a certain pace. And what they had done as they ramped up the clock speed to get the number of computations up, they lowered the voltage of the silicon. And so that allowed them, as they ramped the speed, they lowered the voltage, so it compensated for the fact that you were, driving higher power use. And that was able to, for about 30 years, they were able to keep doing that. That was called Dennard scaling. So as you ramp up the clock speed, you reduce the voltage to compensate. And so that way you don't melt your silicon. So around about 2000, though, Dennard scaling ended. Like we couldn't, there's a certain voltage below which you can't get the transistors to work in silicon. And so once you hit that limit, then you have to come up with other ways to improve efficiency and performance. And that was where you started to see multiple cores in a chip in kind of early 2000s. And there's other tricks that they use. But if you look at the data post 2000, you see that things slow down. And so instead of a 1.6 year doubling time before 2000, after 2000, it was 2.6 years. So still pretty rapid increases, but definitely slower than what came before 2000. And so, anytime you hear the word law, people go to physical law. And that's not what this is at all. This is an observation, just like Moore's law was an observation about how fast the density of transistors would double. And Moore's law also was changed over time. When he first proposed it in 1965, it was transistor density doubling transistor density doubling every year. And then in 1975, he amended it to be doubling every 2 years. And that was what held more or less for the next 20 plus years, was doubling every couple of years. And that was the main thing driving these increases in performance. You shrink the transistors, increase the clock speed, reduce the voltage. And that allows you then to, you know, not melt your silicon and get a lot more computing out of a given microprocessor. So that's kind of the backstory and the summary of the trends in computing that our empirical work demonstrated. And it is interesting because, you know, at the time when we did that, that was 2011 when that article came out. And I didn't think at the time to do a regression after 2000. I just had the trend line going to 2009, which is where the data, that was the data that we had. And then afterwards I said, I should have done this. So I went back and did the regression and post 2000, what our data showed then was that doubling every 2.6 years instead of 1.6. And then I did some work with colleagues at AMD, one of the big chip makers, and they also had internal data, and that showed exactly the same trend post 2000, doubling every 2.6 years. So it was one of those cases where you're like, okay, these, you know, we're seeing consistency here between independent data sets, and that should tell you that, you know, it's a real thing. But again, it's an empirical observation. It's not a physical law. It's not something that's necessarily true forever. And as we run into real physical constraints, as we shrink transistors further, there may be more such constraints that slow things down.
And I bring it up because it seems in a sense to, in light of what you said about peer review, to highlight a strange tension, right? That in a sense, peer review is slow, and this rate of technological change and also these efficiencies, like both kind of like the power we have available to us and the efficient use of that power, seems to change very quickly, right? So would it follow then that in order to maybe counter some of this disinformation, we need to speed up peer review?
No, that's a very good question.
It seems to make sense, right? Because it's like if it takes five years for the accurate information that's actually been stress tested to come out, and we've seen a crazy rate of change in industry, so it's already out of date.
Yeah.
So
I think this is a very good point. The question is whether it's peer review or whether it's another process. And so let me suggest at least one step that could help. People should exercise restraint. I know that's kind of a weird, naive thing to say, but everyone loves the amazing factoid, right? They want something that is stunning. That's interesting. That's what they forward on social media because it's like, hey, did you hear this wild and crazy thing? And the problem is you shouldn't really be forwarding things unless you know them to be true. Mm-hmm. Now, that's not going to stop people from doing it. But certainly for analysts, they certainly shouldn't be assuming or making decisions or making analysis based on these kind of factoids or common knowledge without verifying it. We have lots of examples of analysts taking a finding from a research paper that has actually been debunked in the literature, but they didn't know about the debunking or they ignored it. And then they go ahead and then they do another analysis based on that previous erroneous study. We have examples of studies where we did a debunking and the authors just ignore what we say, right? Yeah, so we say, here are the errors you made. We recreated your analysis and these are the mistakes in it. And the author just keeps talking. Now, it's not surprising when the people, like those people who were promoting the internet begins with coal back in 2000, it's not surprising when those people keep talking because they're not researchers. They're, you know, flacks or people who are promoting an agenda. But when researchers do it, that's when you really start pulling your hair out because they're really not supposed to be doing that.
Yeah.
But there's nothing we can do. Yeah. I mean, there's no enforcement mechanism. One of my old professors, John Holdren, he was President Obama's chief science advisor. And one of the things that he wrote a while back was about the scientific process. And he said, there's a set of norms about behavior in doing research. You're supposed to read all the references you cite, cite them accurately, not misrepresent things, you know, put appropriate caveats and so on. But he said that there's nothing aside from people's reputation that can enforce these laws, right? Careful peer review should prevent some of this stuff from getting published. But ultimately, if people choose not to obey these norms, there isn't some agency that says, you're not obeying the norms, you're banished, right? That doesn't work, right? Yeah. That's not how it works. And so, unfortunately, the media infrastructure, as you pointed out, is not set up to deal with people who are not engaging in good faith, are not presenting appropriate caveats, are not citing things accurately. And sometimes it's just people are misinformed. Sometimes they make mistakes. That's fine. People are like that. But a lot of times it's because they have an agenda of some kind, even if it's a researcher. A lot of them have bees in their bonnet about something.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned this kind of violation of, I guess what we're talking about here is a code of conduct among scientists. When you mention Bjorn Lomborg,
yep.
I think you, who wrote The Skeptical Environmentalist. And so he was previously a member of Greenpeace, and he kind of had a change of heart and became well known for this book and a series of articles challenging the idea that the environment is getting worse and worse. And it was interesting. I went to the Amazon page where they're selling the book, and it boasts of 2,500 footnotes from internationally recognized research institutions, which is really interesting.
Positive or negative footnotes.
It's really interesting and confusing for somebody like me who comes to, you know, and then you see, oh, wow, so many footnotes. Of course, that doesn't necessarily mean anything. So, you know.
Well, this is a great example. It's a great example because the number of footnotes does not say anything about whether the footnotes are accurate. And there was actually a guy who wrote an entire book going through every one of those footnotes, debunking every single one. And so it's a thankless task. It takes a long time. And you find when you do that with someone like Lomborg and those other guys, Mark Mills and Peter Huber, who did The Internet Begins with Coal, that they're just making stuff up. And they put footnotes in to make it seem like they're doing scholarly work, but they're not. And they're just it's a snow job. And actually the book that the guy he titled it The Lomborg Deception, because it was he's just making stuff up. And so this is an example though, because Lomborg gets a lot of attention still. And he's really not a credible source on virtually any topic. I think his PhD is in statistics, and he had one peer-reviewed article after his PhD, and then it wasn't even on environmentalism. And then he decided that this was the gravy train, so he wrote The Skeptical Environmentalist. The whole we used to be environmentalists, and now we're contrarians about it. That's a shtick. Right. That's a narrative that some people adopt because it's profitable to adopt that.
Yep.
I mean, everyone loves someone who used to be something and then became something else. Right.
Yep. Right.
And unfortunately, people fall for this still. But I wish, for people like Lomborg, who've been debunked so many times over and over again, I wish people would just stop paying attention to them, because they're well paid by the fossil fuel industry to tell the lies that they tell. And it's, the media people should be less credulous about this. They should understand this shtick. They should understand the kind of person who does this sort of thing. But there are always going to be people, in the Wall Street Journal op-ed, editorial page or elsewhere, similar outlets where they're sympathetic to the point of view, even if the point of view has no intellectual validity or empirical backing. And that's the nature of things.
You could even see that in the reviews of the book on Amazon, because people, everyone was giving it a 5-star review, and you could tell that these people had been searching for this for this exact answer. They were like, oh, finally I can say that, you know, climate change is a hoax, or, you know, whatever. Yeah. Kind of they were looking for that specific yeah. answer, not necessarily the truth.
Yeah.
And one of the reasons why I mentioned this is to really be clear to the listener who might not be familiar with your work, that it's that your work is really about getting the numbers right, and kind of moving away from any kind of bias in reporting. So I was wondering, when you encounter a report, how do you kind of sniff out an agenda, or yeah. that there's bias in the reporting? Like, what are some of the clues that you look for?
This is a great question. So the first thing, I figure out who the person is, where it's their institutional affiliation. And sometimes that doesn't tell you anything. If it's a university mm-hmm. or, you know, there are, you know, relatively unbiased sources. You could imagine, you know, nonprofit institutions of some kind, some research organizations, a national lab, for example. So that's the first thing to check. The next thing is I read through the abstract, and then I think about in whose interest these results would be, and mm-hmm. see if there's any sort of link or funding or some other link between this person and those interests. That doesn't tell you anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, it doesn't necessarily. I mean, but it gives you a clue. But usually what you need to do is actually understand what they did. And for someone mm-hmm. who's not very technical, who's not steeped in this research, that's not always possible. So the next best thing is to find people who are credible, who have mm-hmm. done that careful analysis, and read what they say about the work. And so if you find someone, you know, like John Holdren, who is the president of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, he's a professor at Harvard, you know, Obama's science advisor, that's a pretty credible source. It doesn't mean that he's perfect, that he's always right, but it means that he's a pretty credible source. If you find yeah. someone else who's, you know, mostly funded by industry to do reports that you know, flatter that industry or make that industry look good, then that's a very different thing. So you really do have to kind of assess people and then find people who yeah. seem to be more objective in their view of things and not promoting a certain point of view. And this comes up in different ways. I mean, so for example, I've done a bunch of work on cryptocurrency. So understanding the yeah. electricity used by cryptocurrency. Now, I don't take a public position as to whether cryptocurrency is a good idea, whether it's worth it. I just focus on trying to get the numbers right on electricity use. And so as part of that, I got a little bit of funding to do a primer on Bitcoin electricity use from CoinCenter, which is a nonprofit who promotes cryptocurrency. But they came to me and they mm-hmm. said, we want to do an objective view of this and you know, what the electricity use is, how you measure it. And we'll give you this and this, you know, whatever, a few thousand dollars. And if you write this report, and they published it as one of their white papers. And so I have gotten flack occasionally from people who say, well, you did this work for the cryptocurrency industry. And I say, well, no one else wanted to pay for it. And they had absolutely no constraint on my substance. Like, they didn't come to me yep. and say, we want you to find X, Y, and Z. They didn't say anything. They just said, write a report that's objective about cryptocurrency electricity use. And that's what I did. And so yep. just because you get money from a group that might have an interest, it doesn't necessarily mean that you're biased, but it can mean yep. that. And so it really, it's a complex environment, particularly with lots of dark money floating around. Like, you don't always know where the money comes from. And mm-hmm. so it's a different world than, you know, 30, 40 years ago, where it was much harder to, you know, to kind of do this stuff under the radar.
Well, yeah, I was thinking that, I mean, it must be, we'll definitely talk about the crypto conversation in a little bit, but it must be also quite difficult too, right? We have various entanglements with the academy over the past decade or something along these lines. And it feels like, you know, as the general economy moves more and more toward kind of self-promotion and trying to get attention for things. You know, there's like a classic example. I follow a lot of the British press because I'm originally from there. And like every week there'll be some new report coming out from like a small university. The one that I always remember is people who listen to heavy metal music are the most intelligent people.
Oh, I remember you loving that one.
Yeah, I used to listen to that. I was like, that sounds great. You know, and then you dig into it and it's like, you know, and it was actually, it wasn't even the case of like a, let's say a bad kind of rogue actor who is pursuing independent research and is procuring funding to push a particular agenda. The agenda in this case seemed to be coming from the university itself, right? Which seems like a tension, right? In the sense that there's always been, I mean, we come from the arts, so this stuff tends to not be quite as life or death as when you're talking about energy or other, you know, quite serious matters. But there was always kind of this gospel in a sense of like a separation between the market and the academy, right? That was like one of the principles, is the idea of saying, no, look, we have to keep this somewhat sacred so that you don't get these confusions, so that you don't get to at least easily kind of point to conflicts of interest. But it seems now that like it would be quite hard to avoid that, or it would be quite hard to avoid that almost anywhere.
Yeah, this is a really serious problem that you're pointing to. And one part of the problem is that coming up with some contrarian take on things gets attention. So even though a researcher may not be, you know, in the pocket of industry or doing something to favor some particular company or particular interest, their own interest is in getting attention. And it's not, you know, hopefully there's some kind of constraint on that, whether it's modesty or, you know, basic integrity, but for some people have more or less of those characteristics. And some people are perhaps, you know.
You're such a diplomat.
I've learned over the years. Not a diplomat at heart, it turns out. But it's an issue that the only constraint on someone who wants to get attention is the ultimate effect on their reputation of making outlandish claims that are later proved to be wrong.
Yeah.
And so that's a kind of slow feedback, right? It's not like there's a big hammer that comes down and says, you shall not do this anymore. It's just ultimately your reputation falters when you perpetrate false statements and people start to avoid association with you intellectually. But that's a long, slow process that happens over years. And there's always going to be someone who doesn't know the backstory and then takes what you say at face value, and it creates a whole set of new false narratives. So it's a real problem. And it's related to the problem of money in the academy. So it's not just that there is this kind of personal bias towards getting attention, but there's a lot of money. I don't know the European context as well, but in the US, there's a huge amount of corporate money at universities.
Yeah.
And the idea that this somehow doesn't affect the research or the focus is, false. Yeah. I think it is absolutely wrong. I think that there is absolutely an influence, and lots of times not a subtle influence, on what's being studied. And so it's a way, it's like maybe it's reputation washing as opposed to greenwashing, right? Mm-hmm. And it's an unfortunate thing. And I hope that people in charge at some of these elite institutions start to rethink their relationship to corporate interests, because certainly in the fields that I'm familiar with, it really does happen that it affects the research agenda and the topics that people study, because where there's money, there will be people willing to study something, even if that thing doesn't make a whole lot of sense from a societal perspective. And so that, I don't know, that's a big problem, right? It's like a big scale problem that's well outside my normal purview, but I see it. And there are other people, Ben Franta, who's at Harvard, has been studying these issues and focused on, divestment among other things, but specifically corporate money affecting research agendas is a real thing. And the universities don't want to talk about it. They want to keep getting money to build more buildings or whatever else, right? But ultimately, and this is where my business model allows me to say something, whereas if I was inside a university, I might be more constrained, right? So what my model is, I do research funded oftentimes by industry, but it's peer-reviewed research. So for clients that want to publish peer-reviewed articles and do real research, that's what I do. So I'm not in a university anymore. I've been visiting professor at Yale and Stanford and UC Berkeley. I was at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab for many years. So I've done the research thing, but now I'm doing research as an independent researcher, doing peer-reviewed research funded by industry. So that's just a different model. But in this case, it allows me to say something about the academy that I've observed, which is that corporate money cannot fail to affect the research agenda, no matter how much the professors and the people running the institutions say it doesn't. It absolutely does.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I noticed in your book that you you wrote about integrity, the importance of the integrity of the researcher or even the business. And that's something that actually comes up, not to bring things back to crypto, but it comes up in the crypto space quite a bit because there are so many scams in that space that if you really want to have like a long-term career in that field, you know, it's very short-term thinking if you kind of run a scam because then you really can't do anything else in the future. But I was reading, I subscribed to the Financial Times and they wrote an article several months ago called The Golden Age of the Fraud. And they're basically talking about how kind of narratives are winning in the kind of public sphere. So, you know, Donald Trump being an example of someone who would just kind of like come out with a narrative that wasn't based in any truth, but that would kind of, you know, go really far and has enriched himself through that process. Or, you know, some people might even point to like a Tesla or something like this. So I was wondering, you know, do you still think that integrity wins in the end? Or do you think that we have kind of crossed the Rubicon and now we're in a kind of battle?
Is there a source of hope
here? I'm more optimistic than that. I do think that when the history of this era is written, the inability of us to be able to impose the real costs of people's actions on them is going to be one of the prime drivers of dysfunction when historians look back at this. And what I mean by this is if you're driven by internal incentives to get attention or to do the short-term scam, but the costs of those actions are not brought to bear, you know, to your attention or to affect your behavior, then you're going to be more likely to do the thing that's good for you that's not good for society.
Yep.
And that's really what I think we see here, because when people emit a lot of greenhouse gases for their activities, but they're not paying the cost of that, then of course they're going to do more of that than they would if they actually saw those costs. And the same thing with the people who get attention. If they get attention and they can scam people and make a lot of money and then they do it again and again and again without consequence, then that kind of promotes this sort of aberrant antisocial behavior. And so I think that as a society, we have to get better at bringing the consequences to bear, you know, the total societal consequences, the cost to bear on people's decision-making so that it better reflects society's interests rather than just individual interest. This isn't easy to do, but we've got to figure out how to do it if society is going to be an ongoing concern. I hope it will.
Couldn't agree more, actually. Yeah, so do we.
We all do, right? Yeah, no, it's funny. Hope it will.
No, it's funny. It does bring to mind. I mean, I wanted to segue into the cryptocurrency conversation, and you know, for context, you know, on this podcast, we've hosted a lot of people in that space. Very few related to Bitcoin, actually, but people who are maybe pursuing, you know, Web3 as a means of building different kinds of economies for different things, right?
Yeah.
And it's quite funny what you describe there this idea of kind of there not being any way really to quantify the impact of people's like sensationalism or thirst for outrage or thirst for something that's going to grab your attention has led to, I think, like some quite interesting conflicts that have emerged online in the past couple of months that have been quite unsavory, I have to say, in a lot of ways, where, you know, on the one hand, you have a similar tendency that you've identified. And I do want to point out that in the Coin Center report that you wrote, for credibility's sake, for those who have no idea and haven't read the report, even though we will link to it, you know, you went in there and it didn't even seem like an attempt to debunk some papers that were raising some concerns around the energy costs or the potential energy costs of Bitcoin. But instead, you were just kind of like proof testing them. Whereas in fact, toward the end, it seemed like you came to a conclusion that was quite complimentary towards some of the researchers, less others. But what I've seen in this space, which has been quite wild, is that, you know, some researchers, let's say the Digiconomist blog post that is probably the source of the equivalent like wild articles that come out in the press that suggest that, you know, Bitcoin is going to boil the oceans in the next 20 years or something along these lines, has in a weird way created like a strange false debate between people who on the one side are either through well-intentioned ignorance or with an agenda pushing those figures, despite the fact that they've been kind of criticized from many corners. And another side that is now stripping the field, and I know you don't have a particular position on the field, but stripping the field of many of the advantages that the field espouses. So this idea of saying, you know, well, actually, decentralization, even though it might be cost effective or energy intensive in the short term, is actually a good thing to push for. And so what's strangely occurred is that you now have a debate between kind of false environmental statistics and then people countering those environmental statistics by saying something along the lines of, oh, we can just have a digital payment system that is basically centralized, but isn't very energy intensive. So we get all of the benefits, the alleged benefits of crypto, quote unquote, benefits of crypto, but we're using, let's say, a proof of stake system that is 99.9% energy efficient, which in a way for me is, I'm like, it can be quite frustrating to look at these things and be like, well, you know, there is an important debate to be had here. It is really important that we get the figures right, particularly whatever side of the issue that you're on. But how frustrating is it that there's all this kind of energy expenditure happening in like online flame wars between two people who are arguing nonsense points if anything, the greatest beneficiary of this, beyond some random like straw man of a crypto person scamming someone, which trust me, of course, there's a lot of people out there doing that, but the greatest beneficiary in a sense is the status quo, because we have no tools in this false debate that has emerged to really, you know, to really weigh up or balance the relative advantages or disadvantages of moving forward. And one wonders if the greater conspiracy or if there's a greater kind of like a bias of these things is to just keep things the same and just like burn off all this. Sorry, I'm ranting a little bit.
Creating confusion is a strategy for maintaining the status quo. Something that
way more succinct than I can manage. Thank you.
So there's a great book by Naomi Oreskes, who's a professor of history of science at Harvard. It's called Merchants of Doubt. And it documents for tobacco and climate how a set of actors, I would call them bad actors, over many decades used the tools of analysis and science to confuse the issue and delay action and to prevent regulation of these industries that are, you know, causing great societal harm. And it is a technique of those industries to create confusion. And so what you've pointed to is a very real thing. Whether this is a conscious, it may be a more organic thing in this case.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's a more coordinated thing, but it's certainly it's a common occurrence that when there's a lot of confusion and ferment like this, that it kind of people just kind of say, well, let's just let it play out. But it does, what you pointed to also, though, is a real debate that has to happen. And it sounds like you don't think that's happening. I don't think it's happening really as much as it should. But let me tell you what I think the real debate should be. The question I would ask of the people who favor Bitcoin and favor cryptocurrencies is, what function does this serve compared to other ways of accomplishing the same goal? And so when somebody in crypto says, well, we can have a system that's highly energy efficient and very low cost, I think, well, we have the Bitcoin. Oh, sorry, we have Visa and MasterCard, and we have bank transfers. We have a central banking system. It's regulated. It has no volatility because, you know, at least for, you know, currency, it doesn't have much volatility. And so it's always, you have to ask the question, compared to what? And you have what value is being delivered? And what gives me a little heartburn is that I don't get very many good answers from the pro crypto people about what benefits this delivers compared to other ways of solving the problem. And then let's just talk about blockchain more generally, because it's the same set of issues. We've been studying this now to try to understand the, you know, what potential energy impacts could be. And people talk about applying blockchain to, for example, peer-to-peer transactions between you have a solar on your house, and I'm going to use some of that solar, and we can use the blockchain to do that sort of transfer without any central authority. Fine. But there are other ways to do that. There are markets that exist for power, and those markets could in principle be extended to, you know, these peer-to-peer sort of transactions. So the question is, how does using blockchain compare to that? And that's, that's what the question should be. It's like, here's a use case. Here's where blockchain is clearly superior to these other more standard ways of accomplishing the same goal. And if you can't show that it's clearly superior, then forget it. It's not worth it. Another example is chain of custody. People talk about blockchain as this thing to help you track chain of custody for something like drugs or something else. Well, the drug companies already do that. They can, if you look at you go into your drug cabinet and you see a pill bottle, it's going to have a lot number on it. If you tell them the lot number, they can tell you where it was manufactured, when it was manufactured, through whose hands it passed to get to the store where you bought it. And so, again, okay, if blockchain can help chain of custody, that's great, but there are already systems that exist that do that. And so how does your new system do better than what already exists? And if you can't show significant benefits, then what are we doing? And I get a lot of kind of fluffy talk, but what I don't get is people talking about how for this use case, this technology will be superior. And
it's a great point. I mean, I completely agree with you. That was one of the comments that came out in a lot of the writing we'd read, this idea of like compared to what. And I guess the difficulty, I mean, my position on a lot of these things is that I would love to see that study, right? Like you raised the example of Visa, for example, right? And of course, creating some kind of a comparison maybe between Bitcoin in its current state and Visa is perhaps an imperfect analogy, right? Because the idea of Bitcoin is...
It's a totally different thing.
It's a settlement layer and Visa, of course, ties into all these different systems like a Swift and a physical locations and, you know, physical machines that are in every store and et cetera. And I guess where we just totally agree is that clearly, before coming to any like sensational conclusions on either side of it, some work needs to be done. Some reliable work needs to be done to be able to make that call, right? Because when it comes to now, I'm certainly not like a Bitcoin maximalist. I mean, I definitely know people who are fully on board with, you know, like the Bitcoin will be the only global currency in 100 years, etc. I'm certainly not one of those people. And closer to our world, you know, these things are like a little bit lower stakes, where, you know, some of the benefits of decentralization and having, like, if you're familiar with some of the challenges that open source software has faced, where there clearly wasn't the incentive and funding mechanism in place to maintain certain code bases, for example, or they end up getting bought up by somebody. Yeah. And, there are small advantages to some of these protocols in those specific contexts that I feel a bit more confident talking about, you know, but this kind of the mother load of the big issue of, like, you know, do we replace, as you say, like how many hundred years of central banking systems with these new protocols that are 10 years old? Yeah, it just seems to me like the only sane response there is just we need way more studies like your own. For people, particularly in our position where we're not energy experts, to be able to speak with any confidence about it.
Yeah, I think that is what is ultimately needed. Open source is actually an interesting example because, like many things in the tech industry, that was a fad. It was something people were incredibly enthusiastic about it, and what ended up happening was that, because it was a real thing and had real advantages, big companies bought into it. And so IBM and others, you know, got involved in the open source technology area and contributed to it and followed the rules. Yep. And did what needed to be done. And so that, you know, that's one example. Linux is another one. Again, yep. Kind of a fad. It was driven by these enthusiasts. But it became this incredible.
No, well, we're going to get hate mail for that.
No. But it became this a real thing. It became a real thing, and because and it became a thing that big companies were betting their businesses on, and now, you know, Linux is the thing that, you know, vast majority of servers run, right? And so that's another example where there was a thing that started with this enthusiastic groundswell from people who were really passionate about it. And same thing with open source. And there are some great things about those concepts that ultimately ended up getting adopted by the mainstream. But it was because they delivered real value. And and then it comes back to this question of what is the use case for a cryptocurrency? Yep. What value does it bring beyond what conventional systems already deliver? And what we've seen historically is that unless a new technology delivers a lot more value, it's very hard for it to make inroads against an established system that works. And so that, you know, it's typically, you know, round numbers, it's like, if you can be 10 times better, then you have a chance. But if you can be 20% better for a totally new system, that's probably usually not enough. And that's what we need to have the debate about. And, you know, these people who are very anti-Bitcoin, you know, that's part of the discussion of whether it's worth it. First, you need to have these analyses of use cases. And then you need to say, well, here's the benefits of it. And then, okay, what are the costs of it? And one of the costs is that it uses a lot of electricity. How much electricity? Is there a way to get the same benefits with less electricity? These are all discussions that should be had, but we need to base those discussions on real data and analysis and not on people's either hatred of a technology or their passionate love for it. And that's what I see. I think that's what you're pointing to, is that there are these people who are very passionate on both sides arguing about whether Bitcoin is worth it, but they're bringing incorrect arguments to bear in these discussions, because they're not really fighting about, they're not fighting about the right issue. They're saying, they're arguing that it's not worth it using various rhetorical techniques without actually having real numbers at their disposal.
Yeah, exactly. And I think, it also ends up caricaturing a lot of people who I do believe actually are interested in new technological possibilities for good, you know? And of course, even that statement is a very complicated burden statement. Like, but yeah, you end up with a kind of cartoonish debate in which my real fear in many ways is that there are many issues both with the financial system and the way that the current technological system works. Like, the current, let's say, centralization of industry in tech. And it just feels like a great shame. And I wonder if it ties into, I mean, some of the work of yours that we were talking about earlier, which is, you know, just general fear that it's so easy to take an almost kind of like a pessimistic view of anything that has a claim attached to it. And don't get me wrong, like if you do go on crypto Twitter, I can completely understand why the casual observer might take a pessimistic view of what's
everywhere.
Being discussed.
Flames everywhere.
Yeah, exactly. Flames and Lambos and like, you know, but
laser eyes.
But the greater point is that, you know, I often find, I won't speak for Holly, but I find myself kind of caught between a rock and a hard place where I'm like, no, I actually do kind of want things to get better. And I do actually really like admire and get a real kick out of some very, very bright people seeing something in maybe this issue or other issues. And the one constant is that it always feels somewhat permissible for somebody to take an almost kind of like Malthusian pessimistic view of, you know, oh, well, you know, humans plus technology equals the world burning.
Oh,
ergo, there's this new exciting idea. So we have to, you know, and so looking for people, and I've been very effusive in my thanks to you in arranging this interview, but looking for people such as yourself has actually been really difficult, where, you know, trying to find someone who doesn't really have skin in the game, but the skin you have in the game that you have skin in is just trying to get to the point whereby people can have a sober conversation about things, which I'm very grateful for.
Well, so I think you've pointed to another area where we should have more conversation. So I talked about the idea of defining use cases compared to what we do now, but there's a whole set of other conversations that are very important about the way the current system works and how it could be improved. And so I agree with you that there are big issues with the current financial system. But I think those, you know, people have kind of reactions and emotional, you know, reactions to the current system that colors their discussion, but they really need to be focused on, here's the system as it now stands. How can we make it better? Here's an alternative mechanism, cryptocurrency or something else, how would that make it better? So make a comparison between use cases of improvement and then have a discussion about, is this enough improvement to make this big change worth it? Is there a way to change the current system that's easier or harder than using this new system? That's, to me, the conversation that needs to happen. And no one should be assuming that the current system is perfect, because sure isn't. But it does some things very, very well. And so, you know, millions and billions of transactions quickly taken care of for very low cost, it does that. And transactions being like transfers of money for purchases of assets. And that's a separate question from what other benefits a system like Bitcoin or some other crypto would bring. But it is incumbent on the people who have the new system to really clearly explain the benefits that they're bringing.
Agreed.
And not just, oh, you'll make a lot of money. It's like, well, that's the people. Some people made money in tulip bulbs too, right? But that doesn't mean that it's a good idea for everyone to do it. And the real test will be, like open source and like Linux, does it become a mainstream thing adopted by big companies that use it to deliver value in ways that they couldn't deliver otherwise? And that, to me, is the ultimate test.
Along those lines, some Bitcoin maxis on Twitter were sharing this thing called the Green Central Banking Scorecard. They just love this because it, and I don't know how credible the source is. This is really interesting to talk to you about it, but it's this from Positive Money, I guess, is the source. And it gives these scores to the central banks of the world. And apparently, according to this report, China gets a C and the US gets a F. And so the Bitcoin maxis on Twitter were like, you know, sharing this and talking about how.
What does it analyze? What's it?
What does it mean to get an F? What does it mean to get an F? Tell me.
An F in being.
Uh, Green central banking scorecard results. G20 countries ranked by green monetary and financial policies. I can send this to you.
Okay, but like you were saying, that sounds like a recipe for vagueness, at least.
Well, that's what I thought when it was going around. But they love these kind of like, oh, look, you know, the U.S. is getting an F. Central banks are already like terrible for the globe.
Well, it's propaganda like, on both sides, right? Yeah. And that's the thing. And the one thing I will say in defense of some corners of crypto, though, and this is an argument, and feel free to just completely, completely squash this. Because I'm happy to admit I'm not an expert on this. I haven't trained in this. But the one argument that I think is somewhat positive in the side of like I've contributed in various capacities to the Ethereum community over the years, and you know, I do wonder when I go online and I say, look, there's a group of people in the case of Ethereum who identified the very kind of controversial energy expenditure around proof of work. This would have been around 2015. Yeah. Designed a system referred to as proof of stake that by most estimations is about 99.9% more efficient or something. Yeah. Again, these are claims that I'm getting. This might be propaganda I'm getting.
Please don't repeat these statistics.
Yeah, No. I'm not a credible source on this issue, right? This is just
That sounds more or less like what I understand. So it's not, it sounds like you're
okay,
in the
great. Yeah, I'm trying not to believe like ridiculous claims, right? But I'm like, well, what other system or what other group of people do I see with a very clear roadmap with code, you know, like the Beacon chain on Ethereum, for example, the proof of stake chain is already running. There are something like 120,000 validators on that chain currently. Have a roadmap within a 10-year time horizon to reduce emissions by 99.99%. Yeah. And it's all trackable. In a complex and a complicated way, right? Because just to be clear, and as your report points out, right, like when you're talking about proof of work systems, traceability and trackability is a nightmare because a lot of these things are very secretive. You're talking about different miners. It's just more complicated than we'd have time to get into in this podcast. But in terms of deploying a new proof of stake system, you can literally watch it. I mean, you can go online and see like how far of this path is going. And with regard to this idea of like, well, what else are people doing? It feels to me again to be somewhat callous or like maybe just kind of pessimistic to view such things with suspicion when other, as you say, incumbent industries, I don't see anything anywhere near as transparent. I mean, or legible.
Here's what we need. To do is there are a set of benefits that are claimed for proof of work cryptocurrencies. Mm-hmm. Somebody needs to do an analysis of whether a proof of stake cryptocurrency has those same benefits or different benefits mm-hmm. yep. or more benefits but you need a careful, it again comes down to the use case. And somebody needs to do a careful objective analysis to say, does this proof of stake system deliver the same value that people are willing to pay for that the proof of work system does? And yep. without that sort of careful comparison by use case, it's all just people yelling at each other. And so, so yes, it's true. You can design a proof of stake system. The proof of stake system is much less computationally intensive. That will use a lot less electricity. People claim that there are benefits to the current structure of Bitcoin and Ethereum. Yeah. And so the question is, does this new way of doing cryptocurrency have the same benefits? And because have been disappointed by the level of clarity in the responses when I ask people what those benefits are, I am still waiting and am somewhat skeptical. But that's to me, that's the conversation that needs to happen. There needs to be a discussion about particular use cases, specific benefits brought by these different methods of creating cryptocurrency, and then comparing them to each other in a fair and objective way, and then comparing them to other ways of accomplishing the same goals. But I just don't see that happening, right? I don't see people who are doing that sort of careful case study interpretation of these things. And maybe it's going to take some time, but it is kind of frustrating because it's really clear that there's a lot of fluff, a lot of marketing hype, but not a lot of really careful work on this. And that is pretty frustrating.
I think a lot of our listeners, you know, many of them being kind of digital artists and practitioners, they're going to want some sort of guidance around how to approach the NFT space, which essentially, I don't know if you followed the NFT conversation, but it essentially requires a transaction on the Ethereum network to kind of mint the NFT. And then if it's purchased, another transaction would happen. So it's not so many transactions, but a few transactions are occurring. And, you know, without these kind of rigorous studies that you're kind of calling for being in place, how should a practitioner approach this space that is concerned about ecological costs of doing business?
I'm still not entirely clear what benefit an NFT brings. The one explanation I've heard that makes some sense is that it's like a signed author copy of a book or a painting, something like that. And that it's that you can say that here's this, but it's weird because it's like it's here's this identical thing that has a different identifier. It's also provably unique in some sense, but it's, you know, pixel for pixel, it's the same thing. So, but people are willing to pay for autographed memorabilia. So if that's your use case, then that sounds like something that is actually, you know, it's a similar sort of thing to, you know, people pay for art, people pay for autographed memorabilia. That's a legitimate market. Like there's a value that people get from it. It still seems extreme to me if one file is exactly the same as another file, but has a different identifier and is purchased separately. That seems a little weird to me, but I'm an old guy. What can I say? But I think,
it is counterintuitive for sure. Yeah. It's kind of the analogy I always use is like a car title, but in that case, there's not like cars, the same cars driving around everywhere.
Right.
The nice gesture, and I think it very much is an experimental gesture at this point in time, right, is just trying to find the ability to create transactions around ubiquitous media, you know, because in a sense, like there was also something really weird to memes, right? Like just appearing as this cultural phenomenon that had no real, that clearly has value, but we haven't found a way to capture that value in terms of compensating the creator.
And
right?
There's also something weird to the fact that in our economy today, digital files are just expected to be valueless.
Yeah, exactly.
Even though they take hours and years to produce. Exactly.
But I expect that the initial kind of this initial rollout that, again, we could talk about this for a long time. I would love to talk to you about it for a long time. But this initial rollout, I think, is maybe like a very nascent understanding of what things are. And of course, a lot of the high value transactions that have happened around these titles or signatures, as you would put it, were in many ways kind of started from or initiated by the crypto community itself.
A marketing exercise.
A lot of it's been a marketing exercise to kind of get people talking about it, you know. And again, I've also found myself in that familiar between a rock and a hard place thing where I'm like, no, there's way more to this. But yeah, the 69 million GIF is too much. But I think you're right. But I think what you're alluding to is that at least from the studies you were doing, you know, even though it is important, of course, to be taking seriously the potential ecological or energy implications of migrating to a new way of doing things, that, you know, a single individual perhaps, you know, sending minting a file amongst a basket of files that is condensed down into a transaction on the Ethereum blockchain maybe doesn't need to feel responsible for forest fires or something along these lines.
Of separate questions. It's like, what is personal responsibility and how to approach this space if you care about these issues when the research isn't in.
Yeah, this is a really important question from multiple levels, because in the climate solution space, there's an ongoing argument about whether individual actions matter or whether systemic change is the critical thing. And my view
seems like both. Well,
exactly. That's my view, is that both are incredibly important, and actually individual action,
just did a dance.
Individual action can lead to systemic change. And so it's not just that both of them are important separately. It's that one can catalyze the other, and systemic change can lead to individual action. So I think
I had this exact argument with a friend of mine years ago.
Yeah, and then, but people,
it's really so nice to
people,
hear that.
There are people who, and this is actually a kind of technique of people who are engaged in predatory delay. They want to make it seem like it's the individual's responsibility, sole responsibility.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And that's difficult because a lot of what you do is affected by the system. So for example, I can buy an electric car. We did. We have a Model 3. Great car. If you operate it in most places, actually, even in a coal-fired dominated system, it's still less emissions than a gas car. If you operate it in Ontario, as we're doing, it's way less emissions because it's 90% renewables and nuclear here. Mm-hmm. But the fact that it's so much better in Ontario is because of systemic change. It's not because of my choice to buy an electric car. It's because they, over years, built the resources and had the hydro and the wind and everything else. So to me, it's a mistake to argue either individual change or systemic change. Both are important. Both feed on each other. For those artists who are concerned about it, there are ways to offset the emissions from these activities. I'm not a huge fan, because in general, I think reducing emissions is really the best way to deal with the problem. And a lot of times offsetting is a way of avoiding the problem. But if you really, really want to do something about it, then plant a whole bunch of trees, do something else. You know, if you feel like there's some responsibility for it, buy an electric car instead of a gas car next time it comes up. Take actions. If you're really concerned about it, take actions in your individual life that will specifically reduce emissions, and do things under your control. And that, to me, is a fine thing to do. I think everyone should do it to the extent that they can. Planting trees is great. Let's do more of that. But ultimately, there needs to be focus on the systemic aspect of this to figure out what value is being delivered for this particular use case. And if this value is so high that we're willing to pay for it, then we need to figure out another way to deal with those emissions. And, you know, putting pressure on the Ethereum, the people who are generating Ethereum cryptocurrency to source renewable power, that would be one systemic change that one could imagine. Since it's a decentralized network, that's hard to do. Right? How do you apply pressure to a decentralized network? But maybe there's a way to change the incentive to reflect more renewable power or less. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But that's the conversation I think people need to have. But if individual artists are concerned about it, then, you know, take actions in your own life to reduce emissions substantially. And the biggest things you can do tend to revolve around when you make a big purchase, like when you buy a new car or you put in a new furnace. And at those points where, you know, your furnace is old, you replace it, put in a heat pump, electric heat pump instead of a gas furnace. That's one thing you can do. Get an electric car. Yep. Basically, the rule is electrify everything you can. And, you know, that's a whole separate conversation, but that's the kind of thing. It's under your control. Every time you make a big capital purchase, you should be thinking about how can I invest in something that has lower or zero emissions. And if you do that, you know, I think you're good. And then, you know, agitate for systemic change. But I wouldn't stress about it too much. You know, do your art. Your art is what you're most passionate about anyway. So go do that. And then do what you can to reduce emissions in your life. You know, don't fly to Fiji on a whim. I don't know how many artists are doing that. Maybe the one who did that $69 million NFT is flying to Fiji now. But in any case, choosing not to fly or reducing your flights, that's another big lever that individuals have.
It sounds to me like we should focus on areas where we do have actual data. So, you know, around the meat industry, around the fashion industry, around the travel industry, we have actual research in these industries of how we can reduce emissions. And until we have further research around some of these crypto protocols, maybe we should kind of hold our judgment a little bit until we have better research and try to make an impact in areas where we do have research.
I think that's true. I think that we need that research to be funded. And so that's the challenge, because the people who are intimately involved in it often are, come to it with an interest. So they're not necessarily... They don't necessarily want objective research. And so the trick is, how do you find that?
We should fundraise for this.
No, I know. Honestly, and honestly, it's funny because this is also one of those things that I would actually be shocked if, I mean, speaking specifically about Ethereum, if people wouldn't be very, very interested in fundraising around that. Uh-huh. The other thing too is, I think it's important to remember, of course, that these things are less than a decade old. That oftentimes it occurs to me that people who know the most about this space, particularly in the Ethereum camp, are insanely busy. And so I do completely agree that the idea of fundraising in a peer review way, in an open, transparent way from those corners of this emerging industry is just like non-negotiable. It just feels like it's so overdue.
It's a real need.
Because then it also comes down, it falls down on individuals' heads who may or may not, because oftentimes it's going to be really difficult to find someone who's an expert in cryptocurrency who isn't somehow entangled connected, in it. That's just a reality.
So my experience has been whenever there's some new information technology that uses a lot of electricity, it always comes back to me. Someone calls me up and says, what is this thing, right? And so that's the weird thing. It's like it's a relatively small community of people who understand both information technology and energy. And I have colleagues now who I've worked with. So we're building up a small community of people, Eric Massenet at UC Berkeley, Armin Shahabi and Sarah Smith at LBL, Noah Lay at Northwestern. There's Jens Malmedin of Ericsson, Andy Stevens at the Carbon Trust in the UK, George Kamaya at the IEA. So there's a group of us who are kind of focusing on these issues, but it's mostly just because we're interested. It's not like we have spare money around to just do research. And so that's another one of these weird asymmetries is that, there are plenty of people funded to create misinformation, but the people who care about debunking misinformation tend to be doing this stuff in their spare time. And that's a real asymmetry, right? It's both 10 times harder and we don't have resources. And so it's kind of a frustrating situation.
I wouldn't be surprised if some folks from the NFT space wouldn't be reaching out in the near future.
It's like you don't need any more people.
or your colleagues.
So I was actually approached by an artist who is also technically savvy. And so he's actually been digging into some of these issues. And so that's an example of someone who found me and said, hey, I've been thinking about this. And they knew a lot about the underlying mechanisms and the algorithms and so on. So it was really great because it's like having a racehorse and just letting him run, And so he really has been digging into this stuff. And but that's the kind of thing that we need a whole lot more of. So people who are passionate about art, but also have some sort of connection to the technology and can evaluate some of these issues, because that's the only way it gets done. And it's a challenge because it takes an interdisciplinary thinker. There's plenty of people who do computer science who don't understand energy and who probably don't understand art very well either. So I think that's part of what needs to happen is we need more people who are able to do this cross-cutting work and not to assume that just someone, because someone knows how to code that they understand energy use in computers. That's just not the way it works.
Very true. Well, you've been so generous with your time, and this has been such a fascinating conversation. I can't wait to re-listen to it all.
Yeah, exactly. And I would love to have you back at some point in the future. We'll try and not like
it. No, sounds good. This was fun. This is a fun conversation. And I think, you know, you'll probably be able to edit out some of those spots where there's like 10, 15 seconds of dead
of course.
Air.
Yeah, but no, we're great.
I think it was it flowed well. So hopefully that'll be interesting for your listeners.
I agree. You're a very easy company, I'll say.
Excellent.
But we do have one question. We do have one question that we ask all of our guests, and that is, what does interdependence mean to you?
Interdependence means that when you take any action, you consider the consequences not just on yourself, but on all of those around you, including the broader world. So you could think of it as, in philosophy, there's Immanuel Kant's moral law, where he says, you know, act so that your action, your moral choice, could, without contradiction, be made a universal law. And so it's like an extension of the golden rule. It's more, you know, more than just act how you would like to be treated. It's act how you would like to act so that the world is a better place at the end.
Great.
That's a great answer. It's actually the first time we've had that answer. Yeah.
Well, try to be interpretive.
Yeah. No, that was a wonderful answer. And yeah, thank you. Look, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much. This was really fun.
It's been really, really wonderful. Best of luck through the rest of the pandemic. I hope you're vaccinated or soon to be vaccinated. And it's been really, really great. Thanks for your time.
Thanks so much for your work.
Thanks. That was fun.
Genuinely.
Awesome.
Okay. Well, take care.
Bye.